The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with economist Jeffrey Sachs, well-known economist who's done work throughout the world. He wrote the book that grabbed a lot of attention, End of Poverty. His latest work is The Price of Civilization. He's director of the Earth Institute of Columbia University. And Jeffrey Sachs, welcome. Good to have you on the air with us here.
Great to be with you.
So it's been interesting. I have actually followed your work over the last 20-some years or more. It's been interesting to watch the sojourn you've been through as an economist. I have to ask this thing first, though, is clearly you're a champion of the free market, a man who's come out of the top echelons, been to Davos back and forth, consulted with Bolivia, Poland, Russia, governments throughout the globe. And then I saw you standing in this photo in the middle of Occupy New York, which we were up to cover. So how does somebody who is passionate about the free market stand in unity and unison with those that occupy Wall Street?
Well, I've always believed, and indeed I was trained back in the 1970s when I was studying economics, in what's called a mixed economy. And that is a market system rather than central planning. And I got to watch central planning up close. It doesn't work. But a market that is accompanied by government, where government corrects the breakdowns of markets, government ensures that the outcomes of markets in terms of income distribution are civilized and decent. The government restrains business from the abuses that business is prey to making. It is that balance that I think is crucial. Now, when I worked in Eastern Europe in 1989, in that revolutionary year when communism fell, there you were starting with the central planning and all state ownership. So I took it to be the task that you were trying to run away from central planning as fast as possible. And my voice became associated with making markets. But if you start from the American situation where we basically let business act with impunity, and instead of government regulating business, we have business that really runs the government, then we have to move in a different direction. We're at the other extreme. We have markets, absolutely, but we don't have civility. We have Wall Street that preys on the population. We have an income distribution that is as unequal as ever in our modern history. We have companies that break the law and then turn to their friends in Washington for bailouts. And that requires urgently a different kind of medicine. So I guess one thing that I felt to be helpful all through my career, which is now 26 years of working with governments in all parts of the world, that you better take an approach like a good doctor, which is don't just prescribe one remedy, but understand the ailments in front of you. Work on the context, know the history, and then do what good doctors do, and I learned it from my wife, make a differential diagnosis. Say, this crisis comes from these problems, whereas that other crisis reflects a different set of problems. So each circumstance requires its own prescriptions.
So I know you loathe the word when people throw it at you, shock therapy.
Yeah.
You don't. I know you don't like that. That's become the popular term to describe the work you've done in the past.
Yeah, again, people throw the term around. I was, treated rather badly in a good book called The Shock Doctrine.
Oh, by Naomi Klein.
Yeah, right. Where she wanted to tell a narrative that has a great deal of unhappy truth to it, because I've seen it with my own eyes. But she wanted to make the narratives kind of a seamless story. So she put me somehow in the same group as Milton Friedman. That's absurd. and unfair, basically. Just, but aside from absurd and unfair, it's just wrong. I was never like that, and never would be like that. When I started working in Bolivia in 1985, I saw firsthand something I didn't understand, by the way, until I got to Bolivia, and that's a truth for me, period, which is I don't get it until I'm in it and seeing it, because it's very hard to judge things from outside, to judge them accurately. But I saw how the foreign debt of Bolivia was crushing the country, and I became the leading voice in American academia, really for the next quarter century, in canceling the debts of the third world countries. That doesn't sound to me like a, quote, neoliberal, extreme free market Milton Friedman position. So I just felt that I was kind of sandwiched into a story that I wasn't really the right character for that part of her narrative. But with shock therapy, I should also explain, it's a term I don't like, but there is a certain meaning to it that I would certainly stand by. And that is that I've been involved in the kind of crises that we rarely see on the planet, hyperinflations, which mean not that prices are going up a few percent per year, but tens of thousands or even millions percent per year. And I've seen a different kind of crisis when, because of central planning, there are no goods anywhere in the shops and the stores and so on. So as a tactic of good economic remedy in those circumstances, I've advocated on several occasions a quick set of measures to enable supply and demand to operate again, either to restore the price level or to restore goods in the shops. That I've done, and it's worked, but not because I'm a extreme free marketeer, but because if you are facing an economy in shock, if you're facing an economy where you need to get the heart going again, if you're facing a chaotic situation of hyperinflation, then history has shown that some very quick measures, really decisive measures, can end the high inflation or can bring goods back into the stores. And I'm very proud of that. But I've always explained that those are just tactics to get a kind of emergency room tactics, if you will. They're not really solutions for longer term ills like poverty or broken down industry and so on. That requires investments, time, adjustment. So I think this is another part of the confusion. I'm kind of an emergency room doctor sometimes that's using emergency procedures to help staunch a hemorrhage or to help get the heart started again. But those are quite different from the longer-term measures you need for a healthy economy and healthy society. Well, indeed, in our current problems in America, what I'm precisely arguing against is some kind of shock therapy, like the stimulus legislation, which I don't believe in our case, precisely because I'm saying we've got a long-term structural set of problems that date all the way back to the beginning of the Reagan administration, and in some ways a little bit even before that. And we are going to need longer-term thinking and longer-term strategies to get out of the mess.
And the only reason I want to come right to this, the issue of Reagan, because I think I found it very interesting in your book. And I have some questions about that, also about your the kind of not seeing the Keynesian example as an example for us to use now. So I'm going to come to that. The reason I raised the issue of shock therapy was because some people would argue that, you know, when we talk about where America is now, look what is that Bolivia, it was kind of crushing the union movement in Russia, and oligarchy took
over. But by the way, that's not right.
Why is that not right?
It just isn't accurate.
What's not accurate?
I was involved in ending a high inflation in the summer of 1985.
Right.
Essence of that was, by the way, just to be technically clear, the essence of it was that the price of oil, which the government sells into the market in Bolivia, was about one-tenth of the market price. And so the government was getting very, very little revenues insiders were buying the oil and actually floating across, for instance, Lake Titicaca, way up in the Altiplano, to Peru, smuggling. And my point was that the whole society was being racked by printing money to feed a budget deficit, and what was needed was instead to collect normal revenues so that you wouldn't be printing presses to printing the money on the printing presses that was feeding a 40,000% inflation. And that's was the essential insight that I added in the short term that enabled the inflation to end. Then in the early winter of 1986, we're going back to ancient history here.
Yeah.
But in the early winter of 1986, the IMF came back and said, okay, now that the inflation is under control, start paying your debts. And I said, no, you'll break the society. And what began was a really major battle of wills. I was a major party to saying that you can't kill impoverished countries with the debts that have been taken on by often, in this case, dictatorships of the past. And those debts were canceled. And those were my contributions. And this is an extremely positive development, because of people who know the history of this country. In the 4 years preceding that, the country fell into complete, total chaos. There were days when there were even three presidents, because there was a coup followed by a coup followed by a coup. There was narco trafficking in the leadership of the country for a couple of years, which completely isolated Bolivia from any kind of normal diplomatic relations. When a new democracy came in 1982, it succumbed to hyperinflation, to repeated general strikes, to absolute utter chaos. It was the seventh highest inflation in the history of the world up until that point. I don't know what dream world utopia people are dreaming of, but what I helped them to do was to take some basic, completely civilized, quick actions to help get the situation under control and to help pave many, many years of democratic governance. And in this particular book, it's claimed that a 30-day period of emergency under their constitution was Pinochet light. That was the phrase that was used.
Right.
Well, this is completely absurd, frankly speaking. I've not talked about this for years, but, you know, Pinochet killed tens of thousands of people. This 30-day cooling-off period of a hyperinflation killed nobody. Nobody. This is not Pinochet light. I know about Pinochet light. I know about people whose brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers died and were tortured and were kept in jail by the thousands. Bolivia was nothing like that.
So,
and it's just insufferable after a certain point, although that's not what I thought we were talking about.
No, we weren't. Today. I actually wasn't going to spend all my time on this. I wanted to talk about your book.
Yeah, no, but I mean, frankly, it's just after a certain point, I was there. She wasn't. This is one source that of a otherwise very good book, by the way. That's just wrong, but enough. You know, so, honest to God, somebody can actually take an independent judgment and take a look.
So let me move it forward to where we are now.
Good.
Pardon. Go ahead.
No, I say good.
Good. So, several things. I think you lay out a great deal in this book, and you lay a lot at the door at the doorstep of Ronald Reagan and the policies then. In some ways, though, there's been a kind of a long road of continuity between Reagan, Bush years, Clinton years, and even now Barack Obama's years of deregulation, of the tax structure that favors the wealthy, of cutting government and not going back to the regulation of finance industry. So, I mean, as you said and as you wrote, it does go before – it did happen before Reagan, but this has been a constant stream. This is a world now that is dominated in many ways by the by the large interests of finance in our federal government. So you lay that out very 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 distinct very very well. The question is, what's the prescription that you talk about in the second part of your book? I mean, you clearly didn't like what John Maynard Keynes did. So
right.
What is it?
I love Keynes, but again, you have to make a diagnosis that's right for the circumstances. And the point that I'm making criticizing the Obama stimulus, which was about $900 billion spent over 2 years in 2009 and 2010, was that it wouldn't solve anything. It was a temporary measure when we need a long-term structural change. And so I said, don't confuse a short-term business cycle with the deeper changes we need in American society. And that's my real point, that if we were in simply a business cycle, then you could justify a short-term measure because that gets you from the bottom back up to the upswing. But if you're in a crisis that has gone on for 30 years of rising inequality, kids that don't get the kind of education and job skills that they need, lack of investment in American infrastructure, a loss of ability to compete internationally, not facing properly the real challenges of China and so forth, then why put forward a two-year program of quote-unquote shovel-ready projects, which the president himself acknowledged afterwards don't exist. Now, let me be clear. I supported President Obama. I campaigned for him. I voted for him. I want him to succeed. I think the Republican Party is completely off the deep end. But I don't know why we need a Democratic Party that is essentially a center-right party. That's what they are right now.
So if the $900 billion, almost $1 trillion stimulus package that went in mostly to the banks and to shore up the finance industry in America and some to auto, supposing that money was spent differently, could you have taken that money and spent it differently and had a different effect on the economy and the nation?
Yeah, what I recommended actually in early 2009 was a 10-year program that would identify how the federal government would work together with state and local governments and in some cases with industry to do a couple of major things. One is to really rebuild the education and the skills training of our economy, because that is at the core the biggest challenge. We're in a competitive world economy. Kids that drop out of high school or kids that just finish high school and don't go on are not going to find a path to the middle class, at least for overwhelming proportions of them, they won't. They need better skills. They need technical training. They need, if they can get it, a four-year bachelor's degree. If not that, at least a technical certificate that will lead on to a decent work. We don't have those pathways working in America right now. We only have one-third of our kids finishing a bachelor's degree. For African-American kids, only about 16% of young men aged 25 to 29 have a bachelor's degree. For Hispanic young men, it's about 11%. In other words, we've got a structural problem of skills, job training, job placement that really offers a way back for America to be competitive again. That's going to take years of work. I don't want to give kids a shovel. I want to give them a degree. I want to give them skills that can last them for a lifetime. And this is a major effort that our country should be investing very, very heavily in. Instead, we're cutting all these programs. We're slashing them. And I think the president also found out you can't build a 21st century infrastructure on a two-year spending program. There are no such things as shovel-ready jobs. To rebuild our transport system is at least a decade. To build a kind of broadband network in this country that's comparable to what other countries are achieving is a major effort. To rebuild dams, some of which are 80 years old that really are at risk right now, our inland waterways, our levee systems that gave way in New Orleans and so forth, is years of work. To identify a new kind of energy system that doesn't tell us our only choice is offshore drilling and drilling in the Alaskan reserves, and not caring about climate change, just pretending it doesn't matter, versus having an energy system that can address environmental realities as well. That's a big deal. But, you know, we have such powerful lobbies everywhere, the oil sector, the big coal industry, the healthcare industry, which gutted any real reform in the healthcare legislation, Wall Street, the arms contractors. These are the things that Obama needed to change but didn't change. He became a, you know, president negotiating with the big lobbies rather than working with the American people. That I say that without any delight, believe me, and the Republicans are far worse. So I expect to support President Obama in the coming election. I just don't want to be misunderstood on that point.
Right, right. And you talk about the need to tax income of the wealthiest more.
Yeah, we need revenues so we can carry out these investments.
So the question I have, though, for you is greater tax on the wealthiest in our society going to meet the monetary demand we have in the federal government? I mean, you write, you know, that the federal government is incompetent, corrupt, but we need more of it, not less.
Right. I said it's a paradox.
It's a paradox.
Yeah.
So the question is then, but is just
and of course, by the way, you know, the resolution of the paradox is I'm not recommending that we pour money into corrupt, incompetent government.
No, I'm not right.
And
right.
I'm recommending that we rebuild government capacity alongside government revenues.
So the question is, I'm curious how you think we get there, because what I'm questioning is just taxing the wealthy without really taxing wealth.
Yeah.
What I'm saying.
I want to tax wealth. That's one of the one of the parts of this.
So how do you,
I think if we put even a 1% tax rate on net worth above $5 million, so you just go to the rich households, the ones with $5 million or more in wealth, and you just put a 1% tax on the net worth, my estimates are you'd raise another percentage point of national income in government revenues. If you end the abuses of the capital gains cuts, the carried interest, and the Bush-era reduction at the top of the tax rates, you'd raise another 1 percentage point of GDP. If we close down the loopholes that the corporate sector is exploiting to put their profits overseas, and we went back to just 2.5% of national income compared to today's rate of 1.5% of national income, you'd get another, obviously, 1% of GDP. If we put on a financial transactions tax, we could probably collect another 0.5% of GDP. So these are all examples of, if we're serious, we can find the revenues. And I've named about 3.5% of GDP right now. Compliance alone would raise another percentage point, because we're just hemorrhaging taxes because we don't actually audit wealthy individuals and companies. And every time we start to audit it, you watch the Wall Street Journal, they start writing horrified editorials about the tax police, as if something's wrong with enforcing the tax laws, rather than letting people just walk away with abuse. But we know how much abuse there is.
And I know you have to run. You had limited time. I do appreciate the time with us. This is, and I hope we can do this again.
I'd love to.
We've been talking to Jeffrey Sachs, one of our leading economists. His latest book is The Price of Civilization, Reshaping American Virtues and Prosperity, Reawakening American Virtues and Prosperity. Jeffrey Sachs, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.